So welcome back, everyone, to the Financial Beast Podcast. I am your host and your BFFF. It's your best financial friend forever, Eric Miller. And of course, what we talk about on this podcast is, how if you own a business, how do you harness the power of your business or your practice, build personal wealth, and most importantly, go out at the top of your game? And the topic that I wanted to talk about today was really exiting. Everyone, if you own a business at some point in time, you have to think that you're going to exit out of your business. And there definitely has been a monumental amount of people that have sold their business within the last 5 years. And I don't know that trend is not going to continue. I hear all these stats that there's this huge, generational transfer from baby boomers down to the next generation. And, thousands of businesses that are going to transfer at some point in time. So I think, exiting out of your business is something that we all have to confront. But then what do you do with the money? Do you follow the same plan that you had to accumulate it? How do we protect it? The hell do we do with it? So these are all questions that I have. And to answer some of these questions, I'm going to bring on two experts, Brad Fincher and Halsey Schreier. And they both work with a company that we worked with in the past called CIBC. And I'll let them explain, the background of that. But they specialize in working with high net worth families, probably private foundations, family offices. And I wanted to bring them on for their expertise in working in these kinds of scenarios. So guys, thank you very much for joining us. And I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about, CIBC, but we'll get into it. I'm assuming when we start talking about what the topic is. But I'll start, and whoever wants to go first. You guys have seen a lot of people sell their business recently, I'm sure. And what do you think some of the mistakes that people have made when it comes to when they sell their business, they get all this money? What are some mistakes that you see that happen when they come into this ginormous amount of cash?
I think the first thing that I see, and usually one of the benefits of working with Halsey, I'm senior relationship manager, managing director. So I'm kind of the key point of contact with clients who we work with. And Halsey is my partner, is a prior practicing, trust and estate attorney. And, one of the things I try to get Halsey involved in situations like these early, because candidly, the thing I think I see the most is a fail to plan appropriately ahead of time. It's an understandable situation, but we see this more often than not. Because, folks are busy, managing their families, running their business, et cetera. That's where the focus is, especially if they know a transaction is going to be on the horizon. And I can tell you, it makes a significant difference the earlier you start some level of a planning process with a firm that, that understands this space and has a background in it. There are a lot of tools that are at all of our disposal to use under current IRS code to kind of to really maximize the advantage of having a business sale. But if you wait until post-transaction, many of those go away. So there's a lot of things we can do on the business transaction side, or candidly, even the trust and estate planning side. But one of the key ingredients that you need for either of those is time. And if you burn that up, you've largely eliminated that. So what normally happens, and I mean normally as in greater than 95% of the time, folks will come to us to sort of help at that next stage. Okay, I've shifted into retirement. This business is going to sell, but they are solely focused on getting the business over the finish line. And I get it. There's a lot that goes into that. Sometimes you're working with, lawyers, you're working with accountants. Sometimes you're working with investment bankers. The deal is altering through time. Your deadlines are missed, et cetera. All these things really gobble up a lot of time. But what happens is folks will get through that part of the process, and we keep talking about planning. There are things we need to do, and they want to table that temporarily. Again, understandably, but then they come back and, okay, the money has hit my account. What can we do to start saving on taxes? I've got a huge tax bill coming at us. The answer is, okay, well, we need a time machine. Remember months ago when I mentioned some of the planning stuff. So I think really the key thing is working out that plan. There's just a lot of things that can be done when we're all orchestrating this early enough. And when I say early enough, ideally, it's before somebody even gets to the LOI, the letter of intent phase, because once that happens, again, some of these tools start fading. So as soon as somebody starts seriously thinking about selling the business, that that's the point at which they should definitely be having a conversation if they haven't already.
Yeah, I love that. Definitely pre-planning for some of these things, because I think the worst thing that can happen, and maybe you guys have seen this, is that all of a sudden this large sum of money, which most of them never seen in their entire lives, gets wired to their account. And probably two things can happen that both are generally not good. Number one, they're scared to death of what to do with the money because they don't want to make a mistake. And it just sits there. Or number two, you know, every cousin, uncle, friend that they've ever had comes out of the woodwork and tells them this is what they should do with that money. So, you know, maybe talk about like the importance of like kind of keeping your team small when it comes to your, you know, the planning process. Cause I'm sure you guys have, in working with families, they probably get recommendations and opinions from everybody at that point in time, right? Of what to do. Hey, you should invest in this, or hey, you should invest in that. Have you guys seen that quite a bit?
Yeah, I have seen that quite a bit. One of the things that goes part and parcel with that is I always recommend, you know, make sure you're working with quote unquote the right professionals. And I wish that was easier to identify, you know, because Halsey and I only work with true high net worth or ultra high net worth families. We know we have, you know, a strong kind of list of who the go-to professionals are, whether it's CPA or T&E attorney to draft the trust documents, et cetera. And, you know, for the most part, most professionals are not going to say, you know, no, Mr. or Mrs. Client, you have too much money for me to work with you. It's outside of my wheelhouse. But what I do see candidly is folks will frequently outgrow their professionals. So they need kind of a deeper bench and somebody to help quarterback all that. So I know, you know, we've been fortunate enough to work with you a lot. You guys lay a lot of that groundwork to start to frame things out and get it in place to be able to recreate the cash flow stream, et cetera, and then start pulling in the other players. So putting that team together really is paramount. But right out of the gate, you know, I think getting the right financial advisor and getting the right CPA and the right attorney, and even if that means, you know, interviewing several of them, you're asking what the typical client size is, et cetera, if that's what it takes, it's well worth the time to get that right.
Yeah. And Halsey, I know you talk a lot about like the legacy planning too. And, you know, how soon should people start thinking about that? You know, in talking with their kids, or, you know, and how do you even do that? You know, especially with, you know, children are all over the place, and, you know, like where does that even, where does that conversation start?
To give you a great lawyer answer, it depends. So yeah. It really is wholly dependent on the family. But I mean, in these situations, time is really on your side, as Brad mentioned earlier. The earlier you can start thinking about establishing that plan, and the more time you have to put it together and then explain it to the appropriate individuals at the age appropriate time is, I mean, the best for the family. I think our most successful families do take that time when they feel it's right. And it may not be during the transaction. I mean, because... Right. I mean, that is a hectic time, and so many business owners, especially, that, you know, they put their life into this business, and they are doing everything they can to maximize the value, and they're finally getting that monetization event, and that's all I can think about. So planning, you know, takes a backseat, and then all of a sudden the dust settles, they've got the account now, and they're like, whoa, what do we do? And, yeah. You know, maybe they have an estate tax problem, or maybe they just have more money than ever thought, and they can help their kids or grandkids or charities or whatever their goals are, and they can finally take the time to do it, but they don't know what to do. And so I think it's really, you know, thinking about early, getting it in place, getting the right people on your side, and then when the time is right, that's when you can tell other individuals. So, I mean, the thing to remember is that you've worked hard to make this money for yourself. And, you know, you want to make sure that you can enjoy it, and it's your plan. And once you've established your plan, the most successful families do share that with the next generation to ensure that everyone's on the same page and they understand what this wealth now means and how to be stewards of the wealth. Mm-hmm. And it's getting that conversation started is difficult. I mean, without a doubt, because it can be weird, because it's something that, you know, not many people get the chance to have, but it is very important. And I mean, a lot of our family, it just really depends on the family. So we spend a lot of time getting to know the families and understanding, all right, when we can sort of push the envelope, all right, maybe this is a good time to bring in, you know, the next generation to talk about. And we may not even talk numbers. It may just be like, all right, you know, we're getting up there. This is what we've established so far, whether it be, you know, just a basic revocable trust with some planning in it, or, you know, some, you know, more exotic planning with the irrevocable trust and gifts and everything, and talk about what we have and sort of where, what if something were to happen, the old Mack truck theory, get hit tomorrow and you're not here, what would happen then? So it's just, it's having that conversation at the right time. And it really is a fluid situation depending on the family and the client, but it's something that the most successful families do it. And, and a lot of families get a little worried about that conversation, but it's better to have it now than wait too long and can't have it all, because that's when you have the real issues. And because the moment someone passes away, things can go haywire.
Yeah. Yes, they do. Yes, they can. I 100% agree. And I think it's really important that you incorporate somewhere where the wealth came from, because in some cases the family members, they just see the money. They don't really see what it took to create the wealth. And I think that's really the most important thing that needs to get translated and assimilated by the next generation of like, this came from this, you know, and really teaching them that, I think, is really important. I think another mistake people make, we'll get to the investments, but I want to just talk about the viewpoint of keeping the money, right? Because so many people, I think when we're working, you know, we're saving money, they're putting money away in investments, and, you know, and you guys hear this all the time, you know, what was my rate of return? What was my rate of return? What was my rate of return? Why is it so important not to focus so much on that after all the money has been made and focus more on like keeping it in risk management? And, you know, is that something that you communicate to people, or is it just kind of a natural thing? They're like, I don't really care how much I make on this. I just want to make sure I keep it.
Yeah, I think that, back to Halsey's answer earlier, it depends. It depends person to person. I wholeheartedly think you're right, because I think anybody, and by the way, this is true of myself. If you look at the account regularly, you're looking at you, what did it do today? What did it do this week? What did it do year to date? If you're not careful, that will lead to wrong decisions. So there's you know, an endless amount of research done on what's referred to as behavioral finance. And fundamentally, what it comes down to is we as humans are hardwired back to really, you know, candidly, the caveman days, where we are motivated to protect ourselves. So fear or displeasure is something like 3 to 4 times the motivating force of pleasure. So we're just hardwired to protect ourselves. And because of that, when things happen in the market, we're hardwired to want to try to get out of the way. But the problem is, if you take that approach, you will inevitably miss out on return, or you will effectively be market timing. Even though, and I have to tell you, I have lots of conversations like this, and they almost always start out with a client or a prospective client saying, look, I know you can't market time. And as soon as I hear that, I know where we're going. The next sentence is, but, and then they describe something and they say it prettier, but what it means is market timing. So it's interesting. You know, there's a few stats I keep on hand that I think it kind of illustrate this, but the key way to navigate this is to have the right asset allocation for the individual. Basically, you know, the allocation that they can ride through volatility, because it's going to happen,
right,
without doing something that will harm them. So it's fascinating what I share with people. I've got a slide sitting right here, because I had a sneaking suspicion something like this would come up. But this, it shows basically what did the S&P 500 do, you know, from the beginning of time up through very recently. We all know, you know, annualizes out just a bit below 9%. So if you put it in there and you didn't look at it again, that's effectively the return you would get. But what's incredible, and this looks at basically a 25-year time frame, what happens if you just miss some specific days? So interestingly, over that 25-year time horizon, if you miss the best 10 days, so 10 single days over 25 years, your return drops from just below 9% to 5.2%.
Wow.
So what it tells you is, you know, each year there are certain key days that you need to capture. And if you miss those, you're eroding your return. So it turns out if you're trying to time in and out of the market, inevitably you're going to damage the return. And the better solution would to have been a less to have reduced the risk in the overall allocation by doing something simple like just increasing the weighting to fixed income. So right. It's a matter of communicating that and then, you know, continuing to communicate that with clients and then line up the portfolio with what their long-term plan is to make sure they stay on target.
Yeah, I see that. So, and yeah, because most of them, I think, most of their experiences have been, well, I got to put 80% of my money in equities and maybe 20% in fixed income as they were saving. But now all of a sudden they come into this, you know, $20 million, $10, $15 million. And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of people that have, you know, their advisors take the money and do the exact same thing without thinking about, okay, but do we need to take this much risk? You know, and to your point, you know, how much, maybe we need to carve some of this in fixed income or tax-free munis or some alternative investments and such. And, you know, I think that's where people aren't really thinking about risk management, at least on the investment side, that much. And, you know, how important that is when you, when the money comes in. Right.
I think you're exactly right. And you can see how folks, you know, kind of reach that conclusion or don't make that adjustment, because, you know, I see this regularly, is that, you know, folks will be in saving mode, and regularly it's not unusual for me to come across folks that have been just saving in their 401k, saving in trust accounts, whatever they're doing, and they're 100% equities or 80% equities, because they know that, you know, they know there's volatility in the market, but they know their paycheck is continuing to come. Very easy to be a saver with that allocation when your paycheck's coming. But what's, you know, what's fascinating is when folks go into retirement, even people that have historically been very aggressive, had ridden through all different types of market volatility and not made a bad decision or a rash decision, all of a sudden they shift into retirement and they're drawing from the portfolio. And then, you know, what volatility they could have easily even managed before all of a sudden becomes untenable. There's a mental shift from being a saver to a spender. So I think as an advisor, it's incumbent upon us to have that conversation as that transition happens and make sure we adapt the allocation appropriately to line up with, you know, with what the client can actually withstand and mitigate. And I think some of that is also just, again, it comes back to the planning piece. I would say plan early and plan often, whether it's pre-transaction planning or whether it's just, you know, portfolio planning. Halsey helps run one of our groups where we do capital sufficiency analysis is one piece of this. It was effectively just stress testing the portfolio.
What is that term? Capital,
capital sufficiency.
You always are good for like at least one or two just huge terms that I have no idea what they mean. Capital
just means how much money do you have and how do we keep you from running out of money is effectively it. So what we'll do is when we build these out, we will build in the amount of money they have, and we can stress test various portfolios from, you know, a portfolio that's predominantly, you know, risk on assets, meaning heavier on equities, all the way down to, you know, predominantly fixed income and everywhere in between. We can layer in the spending, we can layer in the taxes, and then we stress test that through the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it helps quantify how much money do they need today to hit all of their goals. And obviously, we always want to stay well ahead of that. And one of the ways that we take it a step further is I see a lot of candidly overly simplistic plans out there, you know, in the general market where, you know, an advisor may show a plan and say, okay, well, you're going to get 10% a year like clockwork. Well, we all know the market doesn't just give 10% like clockwork. It, you know, sometimes it's way up, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's negative. So when they're spending in the portfolio, that volatility can erode the wealth. So you want to stress test a number of different market environments. So we make sure that we layer in what's referred to as a Monte Carlo analysis, which, again, another fancy mm-hmm. term. But all it really means is instead of just assuming some fixed figure over the rest of somebody's life, we're stress testing. What if we have effectively nothing but wonderful markets? What if we have nothing but terrible markets and everywhere in between? That way it drastically increases the statistical odds of us staying well ahead of the plan and folks being able to sustain their spending. The other thing I think that's important is when you layer that in is to layer in increasing the spending with inflation. Because obviously, you know, as we all know, a gallon of milk today is not going to be the same cost of a gallon of milk 20 years ago. Or, you know, unfortunately, lately, it's a gallon of milk today is not what it cost 2 years ago. So,
that's right.
You know, it's important to adjust for that and make sure that we've structured the spending plan appropriately. And by doing that, then it can also frame out what level of wiggle room do we have on the asset allocation? Do we have to take more risk or have more equities? Or can we have less? And what does that look like? And it helps find the sweet spot to make sure, again, clients hit their goals, but that they're not going to, you know, statistically go through volatility that will cause them to make the wrong decision at the wrong time.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And then Halsey, on the other side of this then is, you know, look, someone comes into $15, $20, $30 million, you know, you all of a sudden become a target. And, you know, protecting the money, because no one ever thinks they're going to get sued until they get sued. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, you have all this money. It just all of a you have a target on your back. What are some things people can do to like And I know that there's like no bulletproof asset protection plan, you know, but what are some tools that people can do to protect their money so that if they do get attacked somewhere, it, you know, they create some obstacles for the creditor to not get hold of their money.
And you actually just used the right term for asset protection. That's obstacles. Yeah. I mean, when I practice law and I even advise now, I mean, when asset protection planning, there is no panacea that's going to fix everything. But really what you want to do is make it as difficult as possible to access your funds for a creditor. So the more things you can put in the way, the more likely they'll settle for pennies on the dollar. So there are a number of sort of things to consider. Well, the easiest, of course, is, you know, making sure that you have sufficient insurance. And right. Something is, you know, a personal umbrella policy that so many people don't even think about. But that's a nice, easy, liquid pile to have that is very cost efficient and very easy to have and set up. So I think that's, you know, at a basic level, setting up those, I mean, getting a personal umbrella policy is a no-brainer. And
so then, what exactly does that cover? What would a personal umbrella policy cover? So that would, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's say you have, you know, a car accident or so. I mean, it, basically, if you go in excess of your coverage in your general insurance policies, whether it be homeowners, car insurance, something like that, excess in that coverage, that's where the personal umbrella policy comes in. It fills in that excess loss. So then really, I think the majority of individuals' risks are associated with, you know, driving a car, owning a home, things like that, where you're going to have that target on your back and sort of in that being that lawsuit situation, the vast majority are going to be in those. So that helps mitigate that risk. The other issue, I mean, just general ownership structure of assets. So ensuring that you have accounts titled correctly. I mean, real estate owned either, you know, by tenancy by the entirety, which is available in many states, which is ownership between husband and wife. And if it's a creditor of just one spouse, it's protected for the entire marital unit. So that's a nice little benefit. Or just ensuring that, you know, you get things set up properly to make sure that going forward, they will be more protected. I mean, you can set up entities. For example, if you have rental homes or other rental property, and putting into an LLC or other entity to give one level of protection beyond you being an individual is very important. And then also structuring an LLC, ensuring that you have more than one owner, because some states like Florida take a very aggressive stance with single member LLCs. Basically, they don't work according to some bankruptcy cases. So you want to make sure that you get the right advice. So once again, going back to ensuring that you have that team around you, because getting those structures in place are important. Now, there are more exotic things that can work. For example, domestic asset protection trusts, which are available in some states in the United States.
Those domestic asset protection trust. Yeah, okay.
For sure.
So how would that work?
So generally, if you create a trust for your own benefit and put something in a trust, basically a creditor steps in your shoes, they can get to the assets. I mean, no problem. But there are certain states, Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming, Connecticut just came up with one that allow you to create a trust for yourself, for your own benefit. There's a discretionary trustee that basically under the rules of the state allow those assets to stand outside of the reach of creditors. Now, will they always work? It's hard to tell, because if you live in a non-domestic asset protection trust jurisdiction, so you live in a state that doesn't have that, will the state court get angry and say that doesn't work? Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
We did see a case like that, I think, out of Washington regarding an Alaska domestic asset protection trust. So, you know, there are some threats to that, but it really bad facts make bad law. So this is something that if you let's say you made $20 million and, you know, looking at your cash flow, it looks like maybe you need, I don't know, 12 to 15 to live off of. So that means you have a little excess money that, you know, you may want to save for a rainy day. Then looking at something like a domestic asset protection trust is a great idea, because you're not giving away the farm and expecting to live off this money, but you're really creating that rainy day fund. So that's something that we look at a lot with clients, as Brad mentioned, when we look at cash flows and sort of this kind of planning is, all right, we need X to live off of and achieve our goals. If we have a little bit of extra, what can we do to plan and ensure that money is either there for the benefit of me, my family, any charity, like, and doing some more exotic planning with that money? Because at its core level, planning is really fundamentally almost the same thing in different blocking and tackling, but it's really getting the basics in place, because the basics are really what are there to protect you. So it comes back to asset titling and then, you know, potentially some other trust and other thing. But it's, if you get too exotic, the regulatory agencies don't like that. Creditors, I mean, it's just, it doesn't look good, and someone's going to come down on you hard. So, I mean, don't never get too exotic in that planning.
So when it sounds to me like when it comes to asset protection, you got some tools. Number one, you said insurance. Number two would be like business entities of some kind, and then certain types, certain titling, certain types of trusts that you can move money into to protect your assets. And all of this, I think, scares people that this is going to cost like $50,000 to $100,000 to set all this stuff up, when it really isn't that much to do all that. Right.
I mean, a lot of it sounds fancier than it actually is, because, because most of it is purely the simple blocking and tackling of planning and doing the little things right that helps you protect yourself along the way. So, I mean, if your advisor starting to charge exorbitant fees, there's probably some sort of red flag there. You may want to speak with someone else to get a second opinion, because you can go down some rabbit holes, and there is no, if someone's promising absolute results, also a bad sign. So it's one of those things where this should not cost that much. As you go up the scale, maybe creating, long-term dynasty trust and everything else, the price tag increases a touch, but it's really, it should never get too far up that chain.
Yeah, I got that. Or having to go offshore, or some of these other things that cost that, we'll see peddled to doctors that, for $50,000 will protect all your assets on this offshore asset protection trust or something like that.
Yeah, so, a lot of those things may start off in a world where, allowed by the IRS or something, but once they become a little popular and more people investigate, usually they can get a little fishy. So that's a lot of those exotic tools may sound great, and if they sound too good to be true, they likely are.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I guess going back to the investment side too, because again, we'll have people that, come into all this money. Like, what level of education do you guys have to, how do you guys define ultra net worth, high net worth people? Like, what is that level that you see?
I've heard this described a few different ways. I tend to think high net worth is probably, $5 million or north, and true ultra high net worth, probably north of $30 million net worth is typically the way that I look at it. Some other folks may have a different number, but that's generally the ballpark.
Yeah. Now, the investment acumen of some of these people, and look, they're very, anytime you have a business that, if you're in the ultra high net worth category, are you guys surprised sometimes at the level of investment acumen of people that have $30, $40, $50 million. I mean, I'm sure it calls you to be like, it depends, right? But does that sometimes shock you guys? Like, the expectations or their overall investment acumen when it comes to this area? You can feel free to tell me a good story too, if you want to.
I think it does, and I'm guessing Halsey agrees, because I know we've seen some of these together. But it does surprise me. I've been doing this now for 24 years, so candidly, it doesn't surprise me as much now, because I find that's generally the rule. But I think the internet probably hasn't done any of us any favors, whether it's figuring out how to draft your own trust documents or manage your assets, or I'm sure going to see your doctor when you don't feel well and tell he or she that you've Googled it and you think you have it figured out, and see the look on their face. So I think all of us, while we have these tools, not all of the things that we find are completely accurate. But just to give you sort of a story, there was one instance that I'll probably never forget. This was probably 5 or 6 years ago, where I went in to meet with a true ultra high net worth family. The gentleman was a prior CFO of a publicly traded company that's a household name. Everybody on this would definitely recognize this company. And I thought to myself, going into that meeting, this will probably be one of those instances where, the portfolio probably pretty sophisticated. I may not be able to bring kind of the full breadth or the full scope of what the firm's capable of. I'm guessing he's reasonably good and well in hand based on what he'd structured. And I found the exact opposite. And it was interesting, because whether it's sort of the regular mass affluent client or even somebody in that situation, the allocation was a bit of a mess. The trust and estate plan was completely out of whack. There really was no tax or income stream plan based on the portfolio. So a number of things were just completely out of whack. And it turned out there was actually a lot of work to do there. And I'll tell you, that's typically the rule, not the exception. I can probably count on one hand in 24 years of doing this, the number of times I looked at somebody's portfolio and thought, I can't have somewhere between a meaningful to a significant positive impact on what I'm seeing, whether it's from a planning perspective, a portfolio construction perspective, et cetera. There's virtually always something that can be done there. And I think a lot of that just comes from, it's all we do. It's all we're doing all day, every day. And we've got a broad team that we're working with. So no matter how good, you know, somebody might be at picking stocks or whatever they do because they're just into it, they just don't have the team that we do and the number of analysts and the number of tax experts and prior trust and estate attorneys and all that. There's a lot of horsepower that we bring to the table with, you know, hundreds of years of combined experience.
Yeah. And honestly, I'd love to hear like the number on that too, because I think a lot of people when they think of, oh, you know, okay, so they save me, you know, a couple percentage points here and there. But when you start talking about that much money and you see that many inefficiencies that they have, whether it's in their investments or exposure that they had that you guys cleaned up, I mean, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, that otherwise could have went by the wayside because they didn't have a proper plan. And yeah, I guess that would that be a fair number that you guys can that you would see with, you know, certain people?
Yes. You know, and it's funny that you say that, because I've often said, you know, several times that I wish, you know, because clients, and by the way, I do this myself. You know, you look at your account statements, you look at what the recent return has been. It's a quick litmus test for how things are going that we all do. But I wish, you know, client statements or online portals had a way of capturing kind of all of the other things that we're adding. And it's just, there's, you know, nobody's successfully done it. But I think there's a lot of other places where we add value that candidly in aggregate add up to much more than, you know, how did we do compared to the S&P 500 this year?
Right.
I mean, I know some of the dynastic planning, meaning multi-generational planning that Halsey and I've worked on together, is going to have, you know, millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars of impact on families, you know, for people that aren't even born yet. That is just, it's unbelievable what you can do when you set these things up and put them in motion appropriately ahead of time.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. Is there anything coming down the pike that, and I'm not going to make you guys put on your forecaster hats because you're probably not allowed to anyway, but Halsey, on the legal side, is there any major changes that have been, that are coming up to date, or anything expiring that like we should know about? Or
I mean, I think everyone's going to hear about this date probably until we get there, but December 31st, 2025, the tax cuts that were passed at the end of 2017 expire. So mm-hmm. right now, an individual can pass $13.61 million onto the next generation estate tax free at the federal level. And so for a married couple, that's over $27 million. That's a lot of money, highest it's ever been. And that's set to go away on December 31st, 2025. Who knows what will happen between now and then? I mean, obviously, we have an election this year, which probably no one's ever heard of. So we don't have to worry about that. But it's something that, I mean, Congress is dysfunctional. So the chance of some sort of change happening before then, probably very, very low. Who knows what happens in the elections coming up in 24. But really, I think the elections will set sort of the course to see, all right, will these tax cuts expire? Could they potentially be extended? I mean, I think the only thing we know for certain is that something will happen. I mean, we've had three permanent estate tax laws since 2010. So obviously, it's anything but permanent. And we haven't had major tax, you know, legislation passed in sort of a comprehensive overhaul since 1986. So it's been a while. We're overdue. I think we look back historically, it was happening every about 10 to 15 years. And now we're sitting here about 40 years from the last major comprehensive thing. Will we see anything like that? Probably not, because Congress doesn't really like to work together and come to really solutions at this time. So, I mean, it's something that we do have this date hanging, looming in the future, December 31st of 2025, that will reset sort of the tax cuts from 2017. But other than that, I mean, I think legislation was at an all-time low last year, and I think we probably see that trend continuing as we look at this sort of bifurcated government that is polarized.
Mm-hmm. So no idea, like, what that, if that did expire, what the number would probably lower to?
Guess would be about $7 million. So it would basically be cut in half. So after inflation and everything else, it'll be right, probably right around $7 million an individual. Mm-hmm. So for a married couple, about 14 to 15 million, probably. Okay. So we're looking at, you know, a dramatic decrease. I mean, obviously, there aren't that many, and there aren't that many families with $27 million out there. I mean, right. It's a pretty small number. But if we drop back down to seven, that's going to bring a seven per individual and 14 for a couple. That's going to bring a lot more people into play, especially with the way real estate has run up in the past, you know, 5-6 years, and you know, and also the gains in the markets over the past decade plus. So I think there's a lot that, you know, it may bring people back into worrying about estate taxes, because right now, frankly, the vast majority of individuals don't have to worry about the estate tax, and really only it hits such a small percentage of people, and it's something that it may change. And given sort of what the government, I mean, where we've seen from a spending perspective, and where even on the income tax side, historically we're at pretty low rates comparatively. Right. And I think, you know, something has to give eventually, because there's been a lot of outflow and spending by the government, but not as much on the inflow side. So it's, you know, something probably in the next couple of decades will change, but who knows what that will be.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. One thing, if you let me, like one thing I'd like to add to what Halsey said is I find that folks regularly think about, you know, the current estate tax exclusion, think, okay, well, we don't have that much money. This isn't an issue. Or even if they hear what the number is likely to drop back to at the end of 2025, they think, okay, well, that's not how much money I have. But I think folks don't take into account that may be the case right this minute. That does not mean that will always be the case. So we've got a combination of the estate tax exemption fluctuating, perhaps going down, but also presumably, you know, if their spending rates, their personal spending rates are reasonable, and, you know, we as advisors working together do what we're supposed to do, these assets are going to grow over time. So just because there's not an issue now doesn't mean there won't be one later. So again, right. It comes back to just like the pre-transaction planning, getting the planning right now and figuring out how much money they really need to hit all of their goals, so we know how much sort of excess dollars there are to work with and hit some of their ancillary goals, really can make a big difference so we can get out ahead of it. You don't want to wait until the problem gets there. You can really have a big impact in avoiding trust and estate tax, and also helping your family, even if there's not necessarily that looming imminently.
What do you guys, when I say the word alternative investments, because I think people have heard that term alternative investments, and it's probably such a broad definition that, you know, nobody's going to agree with that, actually what it means. But when you guys are coming up with an asset allocation for a family, right? I mean, they have the money from the sale. Maybe they have some real estate. Maybe they don't have any real estate, right? Or alternative investments. How do you guys carve that in to the planning? And, you know, what are some of the tools that you use to do that? Because I think that does separate, you know, someone like you guys out from just, you know, an Edward Jones guy who probably wouldn't do something like that. But talked a little bit about the alternative investment and how you guys fit that into the asset allocation.
Sure. So typically when somebody says alternative investments, it really, to your point, it is kind of a catch-all. Predominantly, it means anything that's not traditional stocks or bonds. It can be anything else, which is why, you know, sometimes folks have heard of some strategies that didn't work that well and they're concerned about them, or other times they've bumped into those in a conservative way and they have a positive outlook on them, or really anywhere in between. But the few ways that we take that approach, so you know, kind of the overarching theme, when we're working through a long-term spending plan, we take a focus on mitigating volatility, primarily because all of our clients are wealthy, most of whom are retired, starting from to spend from the portfolio. So when you're spending from the portfolio, there's a concept called risk drag that comes into play it's really, really important. And I think most advisors don't spend enough time zeroing in on that and mitigating it. Instead, really simply, what it means is when you're spending, the more volatility in the portfolio, the quicker it erodes your wealth. So perhaps said very simply, if you have $100, the market goes down 50%, you don't have $50. To get back to $100, you need 100% rate of return to get back to where you started. So the market's already kind of not fair from that regard. But once you layer in spending with that volatility, it erodes the wealth even faster, and it's harder and harder for you to earn your way back to where you started. So when we do the overall portfolio construction, even if it's just stocks and bonds, we have a significant thought toward how do we manage that volatility through both the asset allocation and the individual security selection. Now, as part of this, a piece that obviously comes into play is that is the alternative asset class. The way that we utilize those is to be a diversifier. So something that generally will behave differently than stocks and bonds. And by doing so, it helps mute that volatility or reduce the volatility in the overall portfolio and helps hold up the spending rate for clients. So what we do, and there's a lot of different approaches to this, but as a firm, what we do to help design an asset allocation for clients is rather than just be beholden to, you know, what does Brad think or what do Brad and Halsey and their team think should be in the asset allocation, we take a team approach from the top down. And our senior most investment professionals work with a group called our Asset Allocation Committee, and they're effectively helping drive advice to all of us in the advisor role to lay out what an asset allocation could or should look like, effectively kind of bookending it between a client who maybe wants more risk and more return, and they want, you know, predominantly equities, maybe additional alternatives, could be private equity or hedge funds, mm-hmm. all the way down to somebody who's more conservative and wants to see mostly fixed income. But they adapt the advice over time based on what's going on in the market. So it could be, you know, something we're seeing in the market, in the capital market specifically. It could be some geopolitical thing. It could be tax changes coming. It could be another example like Brexit. When that happened, we made some adjustments. So they're flowing this advice to us. And as part of that overall deciding what should be in or excluded from client portfolios, they're also deciding what the recommendation is on alternatives and recommending that. So they layer that in, and then it's incumbent upon myself, my team, Halsey, et cetera. We work together with our clients to leverage that best thinking of the firm, but then also get an understanding of what clients do and don't want to see in their portfolio. What are their spending goals? What are their trust and estate goals? And then we marry all of that together to come up with a customized solution. But again, to answer your original question, that's sort of the top line approach that we take to help decide what level of alternatives may be in the portfolio.
Yeah. And that definitely will act, you know, especially in years where, you know, I think I just take last year where it was it stocks were bad, or not last year, the year before that, stocks were bad, bonds were bad, everything was bad, you know, but there were some alternative, investments that I know that actually, you know, kind of tempered the volatility of the portfolio, did pretty well in some cases, but, yeah, they're definitely a powerful piece. I think everyone has to make sure that they incorporate that, especially when you're dealing with this much wealth. So you're going to get introduced to things that maybe you've never heard of before, but that's kind of part of the process of having this much wealth and trying to protect it is, you know, you're going to get introduced to investments that you're like, oh, okay, I see where this fits in. Last thing is the importance of like having, and creating like an investment policy. And is that something that you guys do for a lot of your families? And like, what are some of the, what does that contain in some cases? Like, what should people think, you know, think about when they create an investment policy? Because my, you know, when I think of an investment policy is like, these are the eligible investments. These are things that we're going to invest in. This is our process for selecting investments. I'm trying to explain what an investment policy statement would be. Like, this is the process of how we're going to select investments. We're not just going to throw something against the dartboard or take advice from Uncle Al, right? It's going to be, you know, there's a process to go through. Okay. So if someone comes and says, hey, I want you to invest in this thing, you have something you can go back to and say, well, not really following our investment policy. Do you guys find that a lot of people are missing that?
Yes, I think most people are missing that to the extent, you know, that they want that to be part of the overall discussion. So I know if we're acting as trustee, you know, we have our own effectively investment policy statement that swings between, again, more aggressive all the way down to very conservative. But we have a methodology that we follow on behalf of our clients once we take over full responsibility for that. But to the extent we don't take full responsibility for that, and by the way, you know, most of our clients were not actually acting as trustee, but to the extent they want to put in a repeatable, systematic process, we're happy to help expand on that and design it. The one caveat I would leave is I think leaving some level of flexibility to adjust for it makes yeah. sense, because I think what I would, you know, maybe what asset allocation ranges, whether it's, you know, stocks, international stocks, large cap, mid cap, small cap, et cetera, what percentage I would suggest is in a portfolio right now is probably different than what I would recommend 10 years from now. So I recommend leaving some ranges in there to adjust. But by doing that, it will help hold sort of a methodical process to designing the asset allocation over time. And, you know, I think this was sort of born out of largely endowments and foundations, nonprofits, this is what they all do virtually. They, most of them have a stated investment policy statement, and then we plug into that and fill in based on their recommended percentage weighting. So I think there's some benefits to be picked up there for families. And also I think it helps drive the discussion with subsequent family members, with heirs. As the money starts to pass down, it also helps them have that repeatable process to readdress. And it also comes with, you know, providing education. It helps them have to understand these things as they go through the process.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can probably, and maybe Halsey, you can talk to this too. Like, you can even like include certain things like, you know, all right, you can't lend money. You can't, I mean, there's, you can't lend money to certain people, or, you know, just certain things you can incorporate into the investment policy that, that are kind of separate from just the investing part, but, you know, just basic rules of how to make sure this money doesn't go bye-bye. Okay, cool. Guys, we could probably do this forever, but that sounds like a good stopping point right there. Thanks so much for, you know, kind of giving us your expertise on this. This is such a critical area. So if you guys are, you know, anyone that is thinking about selling or going to sell, and you're going to come into a large amount of money, it, you know, look, it's fun to plan. It's fun to, for us to do all these things, but it's deadly important that you have a good team, that you have a strategy, and that you have competent people that are around you that have done this before, that can make sure that they navigate you through this process. So definitely, I'll link these guys, their bios and their contact information in this podcast, so you can connect with them. But thanks, guys, for being on here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks. Have a good day.